The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this Monday evening. It's brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. You're taking Wednesday, Thursday, Friday off this week? I think it's a temptation, isn't it? Unless, of course, you're taking Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Thursday public holidays always, of course, create an opportunity for those with jobs and leave allocations to do so. What does it do to your business? Of course, if you are in the business of creating those jobs, you may want to talk about that this evening. You can give us a call, you can drop us a voice note, or are you one of those business owners who celebrates any break you can get and simply takes off the Thursday and the Friday? Or is it the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday? Or is it all 5 days? We're going to be talking to Dr. Leila Fareed this evening. Leila is the chief executive at JSE Limited. And I wonder how she grows and continues to grow in what is a really low growth South African environment. There's huge diversification of products and offerings and all sorts of things. But in an environment where interest in South Africa is under some scrutiny, particularly in the run-up to general elections, I wonder how she is preparing, if at all, for headwinds coming her way. We'll also talk Stadio results this evening, the university business, or you can't call it a university, the tertiary education business. You can't call it a university, by the way, because government has got a monopoly on the use of the term university. We'll also talk to Sun International's chief executive this evening about how many people are going online and gambling. And I wonder if it's having an impact on the number of people visiting physical casinos too. The wonderful thing about expensive TVs is not the fact that the TVs are massively expensive, but it's brand new technologies that are brought into TVs that cost north of 100,000 rand each. But you can bet your bottom dollar that those technologies will be making their way into your TV at a far more affordable price a year, two, three from now. So we'll look at that. We'll talk to Alexandria Proctor. And that's not a real name. She was born by another name, but decided at the age of, I think, 15 or 16 that she didn't like the name Claire with which she was christened, so she changed it. Quite spirited, I think we would call our guest this evening on our business book. She's written a fabulous book, which is a must read for anybody in your life who's going into business for themselves. It really is absolutely critical. It's all about startup. It's all about the hustle. And it's called Upstart, Alexandria Proctor this evening at about 20 past seven. And then conflict resolution. It's the perfect business model in South Africa. If you are looking for a job, solving other people's fights is, I think, a very valuable skill to have. Give us a call this evening, 011-883-0702. You could tweet us on at Bruce Business or WhatsApp, of course. Voice notes to 072-702-1702. Welcome to The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I had a bit of time today, so I started looking at five-year graphs of the all-share index of the JSE, and it's traded broadly between 60 and 80,000, mostly around the 70,000 level. Of course, there's a brief COVID blowout, which in retrospect provided the best buying opportunity of the century so far, as well as peaking in January 2023, just above 80,000 on the hope maybe that load shedding would ease, that there'd be some sort of growth or some sort of reform in the economy before pulling back to what feels like a long-term average around 70,000, 72,000. JSE holding up fairly well considering the fact that this is a very low growth economic environment. In fact, some valuations are so low, shares are practically being given away. Ultimately, behind all of that activity, the very expensive computer system that sits at the JSE in Sandton facilitates the trading of securities around multiple companies, currencies, bonds, and its chief executive is Dr. Leila Fareed. And we look at this five-year period that I've just spoken about, Leila, and so many delistings and so many disappointments. I wonder whether you're seeing any sign that there may be a little bit of oxygen coming into the system.
Bruce, indeed, we are starting to see some green shoots, particularly on the listings front. Over the past a couple of months, you probably would have seen some interesting trends around unbundlings, which unlock shareholder value, as well as some inward listings. So we've seen We Buy Cars, Boxer unbundling from Pick and Pay, Rainbow Chicken. And then on the resources side, we've seen Marilla Mining, Vanadium Resources, both inbound listings from the LSE. And then, of course, Aurus Resources looking to inbound list from NASDAQ. So there are certainly some green shoots. Markets go up and down, as you know. The JSE is very much of an event-driven market, and when we see a lot of froth or events in the market, whether they be Ukraine, the COVID crisis, a downgrade to sub-investment grade, there's always a lot of activity on the exchange. But we are sitting at an all-time low in terms of valuations of our single-name stocks.
Explain that, please, in terms of the valuations, because this is what Wayne McCurry would refer to as the price earnings multiple, the PE ratio, where you've got massive resources companies trading at multi-decade lows. And that's, I think, a sign of trepidation, perhaps, about the environment and possibly elections.
Bruce, so if you look at how the JSE-listed companies as a whole, in comparison to global listed companies, are doing, we are around about 40% undervalued in our PE or our pricing on the exchange relative to NAV, by 40% to the rest of the world and by around 17% to emerging markets, indicating that there's great value to be had. So on the downside, our shares are underpriced. On the upside, of course, this gives great opportunity. And with the interest rates starting to come down globally, we will see a risk on appetite. And emerging markets are going to start shifting their money out of the Fed, out of the US dollar, and into emerging markets. And if we are able to deliver a relatively stable outcome in our elections, we would, on a comparative basis, look pretty good value for money.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, the problem with this thing is interest rates were supposed to be a percentage point lower by now. We're supposed to see orderly handovers of power in democracies. And at the moment, nobody's believing any of those stories and is quietly sitting on the sidelines hoping for outcomes. But ultimately, I mean, as far as a business goes, the levels of investments don't matter to you as an exchange. It's all about liquidity. It's all about volumes. And there seems to be plenty of both.
Certainly, Bruce. It is very important that investors have a level of certainty economically and politically. On the economic side, I think globally there is a shift towards an expectation that the U.S. certainly are going to start reducing rates. In fact, the Fed will come out this week with their announcement. If they don't reduce now, it will happen in the next cycle. And that builds confidence. Of course, the fact that there are 40 elections and also an election in South Africa in May doesn't help with certainty. There is a bit of a wait and see by international investors on South Africa. I expect that there's likely to be quite a lot of froth in the market just before elections, with investors speculating one way or the other. And then after the elections, if the outcome meets investor expectations of a degree of stability, then we're likely to see those risk on appetite emerging market investors starting to park their money in South Africa.
Yeah, and we certainly hope that that is the case. When we look at the sort of products that you're offering, and I wonder just how much more you can diversify in a low-growth economic environment, because you are squeezing, it feels like, every single cent you can out of every single aspect of every gigabyte of data that you do. You generate, I mean, it's no small feat, more than R1 billion in cash, but without growth, without confidence of the environment in which the JSE operates, do you worry that you eventually do run out of runway?
Bruce, Bruce, markets go up and down, and we have seen the exchange in the doldrums for a period and then moving back up. We've seen tremendous surges in our value traded over the COVID period, some of the highest value traded that we've seen in the history of the JSE. Insofar as our diversification goes, it's much wider than just the information services and data business, which was up 16%. Our JSE Investor Services was up 20%, and that business has delivered a compound annual growth rate of 62% since we acquired it. So we certainly are doing, delivering on our strategy to diversify. What we're also doing is that we're partnering with world-leading providers like Amazon Web Services and others in our carbon markets and our private placements markets to deliver services that would create new markets and diversify ourselves into a much broader marketplace. We don't expect that this is going to go into the doldrums and stay there. Markets, as I say, go up and down. But these diversification efforts just take the sting off those extreme volatile ups and downs in the market.
Dr. Leila Faree, the Chief Executive at the JSE Limited, thank you very much for joining us this evening on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
We're going to hear from the Digs Connect co-founder and chief executive Alexandria Proctor later about just how things invariably take longer than you imagine to show positive results, particularly as you're setting out. And I guess that works for all businesses. Most overnight successes seem to take at least 10 years to materialize. But results today from the tertiary education business of Stadio. It's managed to grow student numbers 10% to more than 46,500. Another 10,000 expected to sign up by 2026. Chris Fawcett is the chief executive at Stadio on the line to us from Cape Town. How many of these students are studying online versus physically at a campus? Chris, good evening.
Yes, good evening, Bruce, and thank you for the opportunity. Yes, without a doubt, the biggest percentage of our student population is accommodated in the distance learning mode. So that would be close to 84% of our current student population study via distance learning.
And is that a dramatic increase on pre-COVID? Was COVID been the catalyst for this huge shift online?
So in Stadio as such, we haven't seen a huge shift. I will be lying if I say that we didn't see increased numbers during the COVID period. However, we are actually seeing solid growth over the last 2 years post-COVID in our distance learning. It continued on the same growth trajectory. But what is exciting for us is we really see the school leavers, the contact learners, coming back to campus. And we see quite a nice uptake in new student numbers on our contact learning campuses.
So much so that you're going to build a brand new campus in Durbanville. I mean, that's a substantial investment, isn't it?
Yes, as I say, very exciting. We acquired that land quite a number of years ago, more than 3 years ago we've acquired it. But we were never ready to pull the trigger on the construction, as we first want to prove to ourselves, number-wise, that the strategy is working. And we've really now seen our comprehensive campus that we built 2 years ago there in Centurion shows very, very good growth for the 2024 academic year. We see student numbers up more than 57% on that campus. So that excites us. It proves to us that the strategy is working, and therefore the decision then also to construct a comprehensive campus here in the Western Cape, where we believe there is a market for what we want to do.
How big a campus? 1,000 students, 5,000 students? What are you building for?
So phase one of the construction will accommodate 2,700 learners. And then after completion of phase two, we would be able to accommodate 4,500 students on that campus.
And by, I mean, based on your projections, and of course they're only projections, where students generally seem to be favouring a distance learning model, how long does it take to fill up a campus, a brand new campus, of 4,500 students?
Yeah. So in our projections, we believe that we would get there in over the next 5 years, Bruce. If we look at the strategy that we've put in place with the number of new in-demand programs that we're putting down on the campus, we're very confident that over a 4 to 5 year period, one can reach 4,000 students on a campus. What will make this specific Durbanville campus different from our Centurion campus, when we open in 2026, we will have a variety of programs with also a variety of faculties, where when we started with the Centurion campus, we had very limited product to offer from day one. So it's a total different business case altogether with this campus this round.
Chris Forster, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive at Stadio on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. And Stadio's, I suppose, if there is a constraint, yes, it's private money and it's cash-paying private students, and it's not a university business. It's a tertiary education business, or a multiversity, as the founder would call it. And they do things like policing and law and fashion and media and design and architecture and spatial design and humanities. And it's what I like about what's happening within the Stadio environment is the sort of disciplines that are emerging now, and they're adding courses in IT, in management and accounting. We're seeing a greater specialization come through there as well, which has got to lead to a more popular option for parents who look at the university environment and go, where are my kids going to be better off? A traditional South African university, or somewhere that thinks slightly differently about the way education is delivered? Chris Forster, Chief Executive at Stadio.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Arthur Karras we go. Arthur is a portfolio manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group and joins us on the line this evening. Bytes Technology, my goodness gracious me, a huge drop in the share price today, a negative trading update, confirmation of more details around the CEO and his dodgy share trades, ostensibly for his wife over an extended period of time, and a big slump in Bytes Technology, a sort of, I don't know, a great hope, I suppose, out of the Altron Group and put onto the London Stock Exchange. And it's facing a lot of scrutiny at the moment, Arthur.
Yes, and I think it just goes to show that that you can have these kind of scandals and this kind of rule-breaking in all markets. It's not just going to happen in emerging markets, but definitely a disappointment. And I think when you see this kind of thing, investors tend to stand back and wait for the dust to clear.
Is the dust isn't really clearing, though, unfortunately, and particularly around a trading update, which management was very pleased to put a shine on, but the market wasn't buying it for a second.
No, I mean, this is not a company, I think, that's getting a lot of attention from local investors. You know, it used to be an IT reseller in South Africa, and I think it's kind of tried to reinvent itself by going offshore. But I think this kind of thing, I think we've had enough of the experience of this kind of thing to know that that the negative story can drag on for quite some time. Some people talk about the cockroach theory. You know, if you spot one cockroach, that means there's probably still a lot more that you haven't seen yet.
I'm sorry, I'd forgotten about the cockroach theory. It tickles my funny bone. Lots of metrics in the discovery trading update. And there are 1,000 measures by which you can judge the performance of a company. The market didn't like the measures that Discovery put out today.
I think you need to just stand back a bit and wait for the full result. I think with Discovery, there's two issues. I think everyone's always a little concerned about their ability to generate cash relative to the profits that they report. So I think the market can be a bit skeptical about reported profits because they want to see the cash. The other thing on top of that is all of the insurance companies, their results are quite tricky to get through at the moment because they've had this change in accounting standards. and that means you get some quite weird things happening in terms of reporting relative to an adjusted base in the past, as against, you know, what you remember they reported last time. So there's going to be a lot of funnies in these results. All the insurance companies' results all kind of need to try and figure out, well, you know, make sure we're comparing apples with apples. So when it comes to Discovery, I would say just need to wait a little bit. Let's see the full result out. Let's see all of the changes to the accounting standards, and let's see how much cash they actually produce.
And some really nice results coming out today as well. I mean, Stadio, JSE Limited, Sun International, all pretty solid.
Yes, and I think a lot of those results coming off quite weak top lines. Yeah, I heard the discussion with the JSE CEO, and that just shows the benefit of a business where they hold a lot of cash. So they, you know, they did manage to boost their results by as a result of the high interest rates that we're experiencing in the country. So they sit on a large cash pile. So that helped nudge those results up a bit more positively. The Stadio results similarly, you can see the positive trends there, but disappointing to see the much, much larger provision that they needed to make in terms of fees that they might not be able to collect from some of their students, but that does make sense given the economic environment that we're in. So I think you can see companies working hard to make their profits. A good example would be if you dig into the Sun International results, you can see that Sun City produced a much better result off a pretty much unchanged top line, but they worked really hard to get the costs down. So really working hard to make the profits go up.
Thank you, Arthur Karras, for that wonderful summary this evening, Portfolio Manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
So, Legale, thank you very, very much indeed. Anthony Leeming standing by, Chief Executive at Sun International. Catch up with him in just a moment. On your next Money Show, Nicole Funden-Munkhoff, Certified Financial Planner at Independent Securities, looking at the big life events, which mean you need to plan for every scenario, or as many of them as possible. She'll tell us more. Then Rona Kapaldas, who's Director and Africa Analyst at Signal Risk, also with an Africa update for us, plus all of the other big money stories, including a deal between an online booze delivery business and Norman Goodfellows. Next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Well, the star of the show for Sun International is SunBet, the online sports betting and gaming platform, but Sun City also making something of a comeback in these results. Anthony Leeming is the Chief Executive at Sun International on the line to us this evening. The split between sports betting and online casino games, Anthony, what is that split within this rapidly growing SunBet environment?
Good evening, Bruce. Good evening to your listeners. Look, the sports is probably about 20% of our online business, with live tables of dealer games being about 20, and the balance really slots. There's a little bit of other sort of games, but that's the bulk of it. So it really boils down to mostly casino games, about 80% of our revenue.
I'm surprised by that, actually. I thought, would have thought sports betting was a bigger proportion, but that's interesting. Definitely a big shift for you online. You've got record income, record profitability coming through for SunBet, exceeding even your 5-year targets. Now, is that a sort of a COVID hangover, or is this the future? Are you seeing the future unravel before you?
No, I think it is definitely the future online play, but it's not going to be the be all and end all. Our land-based casinos still perform very well, and we still expect strong growth coming out of them and also a good cash flow. So, yes, it's a change, and certainly it's a boost, but I think it is a new business. I think, you know, it's, when you look at sport book betting has been around for a long, long time, online sports betting, that is, and I think that market's a little more mature, whereas we are finding there's a lot more out there who are keen to play sort of more casino-style games online.
I was at Jimmy Carr in Cape Town recently, and I noticed that the machines were humming in the casino. The tables were quiet, though, and I wondered if that was just because it was early in the evening, or whether people are showing a preference for machines, and that preference for machines therefore translates quite easily into an online gaming environment. Is there a correlation?
No, definitely not. I mean, our tables business has actually been a larger portion of our revenue when you look since COVID. It's actually increased as a percentage of revenue rather than reduced. So it might have just been the time of the evening. I also think, you know, this game is quite different playing in an online computer compared to playing in a big slot machine in a busy casino with more activity. So it is, I don't see it quite as the same game, and we do have overlap. There are people that play both, but certainly we do feel quite strongly that they are lots of different markets, different people, while there is obviously still overlap.
So the tables are still alive and well, because if you watch a James Bond movie, if you watch Casino Royale or any of the myriad of Las Vegas movies, it's always all about the tables. So tables are still very significant as part of the casino mix.
Well, I think in South Africa, slots have traditionally been a larger share of revenue. It's circa 80% and higher, but some of our casinos' tables are 30%. What we are seeing that the tables have increased over time, particularly since 2019. So, yes, slots are still the predominant game in South Africa, while tables do take, are still growing and still a significant part of our business.
I suppose more serious gamblers or more serious gamers, whatever you want to call them, are going to be the sorts of people who sit down and, you know, command an audience and sort of have a more sort of public display, perhaps, of skill, luck, whatever it might be.
Yeah, look, I think they are a different type of gambler, but certainly they both have their appeal and they both have their market. And we are seeing pretty good growth in obviously tables, as I mentioned. They have the different market and different players that play them.
In terms of psychology, though, of people who are betting, you need excess capital or excess cash at least to indulge in online gaming, in casino betting as well. I wonder, is there any way of measuring in tough times whether there are acts of desperation, the last throw of the die, literally, or whether or not there is actually quite a lot of economic activity happening in South Africa that doesn't get reflected necessarily in the GDP numbers that finds its way to your tables?
Look, it's definitely more the latter. We don't, we are the elements of problem gaming, absolutely. We take it very seriously, and the industry has a responsible gaming program, and we do look out for it, and we often have to speak to players. But generally, it is people with money that are gambling. Most of our revenue comes from the wealthier side of the population. So there's always an element of desperation, but it's a very small part of it, and we focus on that quite seriously.
Gaming's always been, of course, the lion's share of what you do. This time around, 77% of total group income comes from gaming. That feels like a higher proportion than previously.
Well, I think for the growth in Sunbet, it's sort of a new revenue. So, I mean, there's 700 odd million there, which is also gaming. So I guess that's what pushed a little bit more in that favor. But if you look at the hotel and resorts, they actually increased their contribution. Urban casinos declined a bit, and so did LPMs. So our hotels, in particular sort of Sun City, Table Bay, had a phenomenal performance. So Sun City this year is record income. Record profitability, 455 million. And I think it contributed positively to the business. People have always looked at Sun City and said it's a bit of a cash cow, using too much cash, I should say. But when we look forward, we see really good profitability coming out of it and a business that's in very, very good shape.
Any obstacles emerging to your planned takeover of Pyrmont? We've seen competition authorities getting very sticky on various issues in recent times. Your own shareholders have unanimously supported the takeover of Pyrmont. It brings 11 properties, South Africa, Botswana, also an online gaming business into the fold. Should it be approved? Any obstacles emerging?
No, it's still early stages. We haven't yet engaged with the competition authorities, but we will soon enough. I think if you look at the industry, we still contribute meaningful to all sort of social causes, whether it be through ED, through procurement, through bursary schemes, training, education. So I think the industries are really well, for the public interest is good. We will have no retrenchments. So we're really offering the commission a lot of things that they look for. So we've agreed to no major-rated retrenchments. We've agreed to retain all staff. And so I do think we've got a compelling package where the competition authorities should approve without any real hurdles.
Thank you, Anthony Leeming, Chief Executive at Sun International this evening on The Money Show. Really good performance coming through across the Sun International business, but most notably out of SunBet, the online gaming business, which is a split between sports betting and casino games, and those casino games are split down further. I would have thought sports betting would be bigger. Turns out it's not. Only 20% of the online gaming, and people play online games and bet. And I get the excitement and the thrill of a casino. I really do, which is why I don't go there. Not often anyway. And when I do, it's only with small and young change. It really is. I can't bear to risk money in that way. It's just not part of my nature. But when you win, oh, my goodness gracious me. Oh, but loss aversion is real. It's real when it comes to placing a bet. And so it's never a very serious occupation of mine, and only very, very occasionally. Are you one of those people who goes and bets online? And I wonder if you take comfort from the fact that, you know, there are a billion places, I'm sure, online where you can gamble. But my goodness me, would you trust them? It's like so many cryptocurrency trading platforms. You want to go somewhere where you can recognize a brand, where there's maybe a physical presence somewhere. And I wonder if that is playing in Sun International's favor, that SunBet is connected to Sun International, which is Sun City. And there's an element of familiarity. I wonder if that helps. Are you one of those people who likes to gamble online? How do you do it? On your phone? Do you do it in the bath, in bed, on the loo? I don't know. Are you one of those people who gambles? I'm curious as to the psychology of what it is about sitting quietly by yourself and putting money on bets. It's, I find it unusual, very unusual. Let us know.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Talks about outrageously expensive TVs, not because I plan to buy one, but because it tells me about the technology that will soon be available in cheaper TVs, for which I might be in the market. That is the way it works, though, isn't it, Toby Shapshak, the chief at Stuff Studios? We see these launches of these astonishing devices that break every boundary and every barrier of televisual history. And before long, the tech finds its way into our lounges.
Yes, indeed they do. Bruce Whitfield, the chief of business journalism, business radio journalism, I might add. But exactly, Bruce. And what's, you know, people say, well, it's very high end and it's, you can only get it in this the 77-inch model that I saw last week is 130,000 Rand, but there's also an 83-inch and a 97-inch, and those will obviously be more expensive. But it's this technology innovation at the top, at the high end, that filters down to the low end or to the mid-range. In fact, to the whole range of products. And I would try to, you know, do my best Meryl Streep impersonation and say, you know, remember what she says in The Devil Wears Prada, you know, you turn your nose up at this. She's speaking to the young Anne Hathaway, who seems to hate fashion, even though she's in fashion. And she says to her, you turn your nose up at this high end fashion, but what you see on the runway today, you'll see in the high street, you know, in 6 months to a year's time. And that's why I'm so interested in these massive breakthroughs. And I was hell of impressed, Bruce, and only a South African could say the word hell of on radio and get away with it. LG calls it the world's first completely wireless OLED television. And what's interesting about it is that apart from the power cable, you don't have any other ports or cables plugged into the television. Instead, you have them plugged into a kind of square black box that they call Zero Connect box. And as long as it's 10 meters away from the TV, but better if it's line of sight, you can plug all sorts of things into that. Bluetooth players, if you do it, or streaming, or game console, anything that you would normally plug into the back of the TV, you plug into this box, and the box is what streams it using radio frequencies to the TV. And the guy showing it to us at the Digital Experience last week was showing how he could put a phone that was emitting, you know, phone signals, and the Zero Connect box would redirect itself around to, you know, to optimize its signal to the TV. So really impressive. I mean, a lot of people are saying it's a solution looking for a problem, but I disagree. People want to have a TV that is mounted perhaps on a glass wall or without cables hanging from it or behind it. And it's also, as you know, anyone who's ever put cables into the wall, what a schlep it is. And you can have everything except the power connected to the TV. Now, that makes perfect sense to me because power is a very easy thing to run. You can run that power cable quite long without losing signal, whereas if you do it with an HDMI cable or any of the other cables, it's quite difficult. So I think there's a real application for this. And as you say, and as Glenn Close says, you know, it starts in the high end and it moves its way to the rest of the range, the bottom and the mid range. But I tell you the other thing I like about LG TVs, and I've only ever had LG TVs since my last Sony Bravia, they use a wonderful operating system to get around the TV, which is called WebOS. And Bruce, and you will remember this because I'm sure you had one as well, a Palm Pilot. Anyone who ever had a Palm Pilot will know. Yes, and this so the software was sold HP sold from 3Com, who had bought Palm. They sold it to HP. HP made one phone, and a very good phone called a Palm Pre, P-R-E. And then they sold that, they called that software WebOS, and they sold it to LG, and LG has been using it as their TV software. And I can tell you, Bruce, there's something intuitive about LG's TV software that I don't find in the other software programs, and the fact that their remote control, they call it a magic remote, it's very clever. You know, they've done a little bit of logical thinking. So if you want to go back, you move your thumb down and to the left, which is the most natural movement for your thumb. Everybody else has amazing. A top right or top left.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a wonderful all-in package. The whole thing is called the LG M3 OLED wireless TV, the world's first completely wireless OLED television, Bruce.
But I love the intuitive thinking of this, because I remember Laurie Dippenard once saying, I said, if you could improve one thing in the world, what would it be? And he said, TV remote controls, because it's got 1,000 buttons and you only ever use, you know, the on-off button and the channel button and maybe the volume.
Exactly, and volume.
And then Apple TV came out with their wonderfully intuitive little touch device. And if LG is also thinking about the user, well, that's massively encouraging.
I think Apple went too far. The second, the more advanced TV remote is better. The original one that just had like three buttons, that lacked finesse. It was quite difficult. Also, you know, LG knows you're going to want to change channels. You're going to want to input numbers. So I think that's quite clever. The other thing about it, I should say, Bruce, is that it's got, you know, for many years, LG's TVs have come with a dedicated button for Netflix and Amazon Prime. And I'm sure Showmax would love to get their button dedicated. But it, you know, the new remotes from LG come with like six or, you know, more dedicated buttons. So you can push one button and go straight to Netflix or Amazon Prime. I think you can set some of the other ones. So that's a useful feature. And of course, OLED is a remarkable organic LED light emitting diode. These things they're self-lit, so there's no backlight. Each individual pixel, Bruce, has its own light. They call it a multi-lens array, and it's really quite phenomenal. I mean, you'll never hear me talk about processors in television, Bruce, but this is powered by the Alpha 9 Gen 6 processor. It's really quite something.
Toby Shapshak, the chief at Stuff Studios. Thank you, Toby. Lovely review of the M3 OLED wireless TV. And it comes from LG, of course, the LG M3. Rhymes, so you know what to do. Starting at 130,000 Rand for the little one at 77 inches, and you measure TVs from bottom corner to top corner or top corner to bottom corner, depending on your proclivities. And there are bigger ones, 83 and 97 inch sizes. And, well, you're never going to spend 130,000 Rand on a TV. Of course you are unlikely to do that. Most people aren't going to be that insane. But the tech that is coming out of these innovations is going to come to a 10, 20 grand TV near you in the not too distant future. Eyewitness News in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to talk tough times and their consequences. Dr. Eric Levenstein, the head of insolvency and business rescue at Worksmen's Attorneys, joins us. We'll reflect a little bit about a warning, I think it was, from Deloitte today, all about slowdowns and difficulties. We'll also chat to Alexandria Proctor. Now, that name may not make sense to you, but you would have seen her very catching book on bookshelves in stores and online. It's called Upstart, and it's got a picture of her with a baseball cap on and looking just free and breezy. And she doesn't look like somebody who's been through the mangle. It was an old-fashioned laundry thing in the 1800s, the mangle of startup. And I think that's the best way to describe it, startups, as being pulled through a mangle. The story is raw. The story is vulnerable. The story is astonishing. And everybody who you know, whoever wants to start anything, should read it before they even begin to think about seriously doing it. Because I think it's ruthless and brutal. I think it is, in terms of spells out just some of the great difficulties of people who start businesses. And then at 7:30, South Africa's favorite national occupations, other than shooting ourselves in the foot, jumping to conclusions, is picking fights with each other. It's what we like to do. And where there is conflict, there is a business solution to that conflict. And so really looking forward to catching up with somebody I've been following on social media for an awfully long time. And that's André Flock, who is the conflict and employment dispute specialist negotiator. And it's how he makes money. I'm going to catch up with him coming up this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, Deloitte today announcing the biggest review of its global operations in about 10 years. Like many businesses, it wants to simplify and it wants to cut costs. Well, like many, it's expecting a slowdown, a global slowdown. It'll cut its divisions from 5 to 4. It'll keep audit, obviously, strategy, tech and legal advisory. It's going to take about a year to implement across all 150 countries in the network, including, of course, South Africa, where the company also operates. It employs about 400, this was an astonishing statistic actually, it employs 455,000 people around the world. That's an awful lot of brain power in one organization. It's the biggest of the big four firms. It's got about $65 billion a year in revenue, but they are bracing for a difficult economy, a more difficult economy worldwide. And that kind of makes sense, I suppose. We've had a relatively good recovery, if you're American, from the COVID crisis, and that economy has grown, and jobs have grown, and stock markets there have grown. The rest of the world not doing as well. And yes, South Africa certainly won't escape any effects of a slowdown of any measure anywhere. And the head of insolvency and business rescue practice at Worksmen's Attorneys is Dr. Eric Levenstein. And Eric, we look at the environment in which companies in South Africa are thriving, some are struggling, and some are dying, unfortunately. And January was a particularly rough month for South African businesses.
Yes, Bruce. I mean, the statistics, South Africa pushed out statistics quite recently, and it showed that 109 businesses closed down in January of this year, which is a startling number, with 34.6% increase in the total number of liquidations in January. So there's certainly pressure on the economy, and I think directors of companies, obviously with stresses relating to issues with electrical supply and whatever else they are facing, are looking at alternatives like business rescue and liquidations. And I think for directors of companies that are financially distressed, the optionality of continuing to trade in insolvent circumstances when they cannot pay ongoing suppliers, and placing themselves into a very difficult position, often ending in liquidation.
Are the numbers that different? If we look at long-term trends, I mean, Pablo Fatidis always tells us 94% of businesses that are founded are never sold. They either die with the founder, they become a job, or they go bust at some point, or, you know, very few are actually acquired and grow into anything more substantial. I wonder if the long-term trends, based on your experience, Eric, are showing a marked deterioration in the environment.
Well, I mean, if you look at SIPC's recent status report, which is the Company's Intellectual Property Commission, in February 2024, 17% of entities started business rescue proceedings. So that's not liquidation. obviously trying to restructure debt, contracts, and maybe even the workforce. So yes, the trends are pretty cyclical, Bruce. But, you know, the sectors that are struggling remain consistent. If you look at the statistics a year ago, I don't think they reflect a very different position. Mainly the stresses in the manufacturing industry, agriculture, and mining. Mining is taking a massive pounding, and we've seen more, let's say, financially distressed companies in the mining sector towards the latter half of last year than we've ever seen before. So the trends are, you know, up and down. I don't think it's pretty sector agnostic. I don't think you can focus on any one particular sector, but at the end of the day, it's companies that are struggling to pay their debts and to pay suppliers on an ongoing basis.
And that, of course, has a dreadful knock-on impact. And obviously, your appeal is to get more people to apply for business rescue before it's too late to do the rescue. Are we seeing more satisfactory outcomes coming from business rescue? Are people still holding on too long?
Well, again, Bruce, SIPSI put out statistics which show 36% of companies last year, in the first final quarter of last year, rather, were successfully rescued by way of business rescue plans. Now, of course, directors who leave it too late, let's say small private-owned companies where there's been an historical hand-down of the business over decades, and let's say family-run businesses, will hold on for far too long. They're emotionally linked to the success of their business and are not prepared to put their hands up and say, well, I need help, or we need help as a board to run this business. Let's get in some advisors to see whether or not there's something left to rescue here. So by the time they, in fact, file for business rescue, there's not much left to rescue. And in fact, the business rescue plan fails and often the company ends up in liquidation. I'm not saying that applies across the board. Seen some real good successes, some in the agricultural sector, some in the manufacturing sector. It's about getting in early, taking proper advice, and being big enough to say we need outside external assistance.
Dr. Eric Levenstein, thank you, the head of insolvency and business rescue practice at Worksman's Attorneys this evening. Thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight here on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Business books.
And we'll get to Alexandra Proctor in just a moment. And this is truly a book that I loved. I devoured it. And I didn't necessarily think I was going to love it. It had my name on the front because I'd once said something positive about Alexandra Proctor. I think I described her as a force of nature or something like that. And she then, as the hustler that she is, grabbed it and stuck it on the front page of her book. And she didn't even ask. That's why I read it, because I went, oh, that's cocky. Because people usually ask that question, you see. But I don't think she asks for permission. And I don't think she asks for forgiveness often either. She's the founder of Digs Connect and the author of a fabulous book called Upstart. And I thought I knew enough about Alexandra Proctor and, of course, Digs Connect, the business that she co-founded, to satisfy my curiosity. I mean, she's 30-something. What can she teach the world? Oh, my goodness gracious me. It turns out a huge amount. And as I said earlier, if you or anyone in your life is considering embarking on a journey of starting a business, even a side hustle, which might become a business one day, I really cannot recommend this book enough. I love that you don't seem to have an edit button, Alexandra Proctor. There's almost like 250 pages of warts and all, conscious or unconscious narrative that just sort of explodes across pages. Do you have an edit button? Is there an off button in the world of Alexandra Proctor?
Almost certainly not. There's only a go faster button. Scream to go faster is what I say.
Take us through just the quick journey, just the potted history, 90 seconds if you wouldn't mind, just of Digs Connect, the origins. You are not the most likely candidate to become elected to an SRC. You don't follow the rules. You don't win a place. You get a place on the SRC at UCT. You get given the worst job on the SRC, and it kind of turns into a business. Update, please.
Yes, it was called the Cursed Portfolio, student housing, because everyone kept trying to fix and it couldn't get anywhere with it. And then in a blaze of chaos, which was, you know, all the protesters swept the nation, fees must fall, roads must fall, students just saying they'd had enough, taking to the streets, you know, nationwide. Part of that was a shack that was erected up on upper campus at UCT. saying, you know, this is the state of our nation. You should see Shack for accommodation crisis. I remember looking at this thinking, you know, why is nothing being done? And I think it's a question everyone asks themselves looking at the world, why is nothing being done? And it's like this, you know, before you take the leap, it seems always impossible. But once you've taken the leap, it's so obvious. It's like, you know, not waiting around being like, why is no one doing something? It's why didn't I do anything sooner? And they're just doing that. So be confronted by this housing crisis, realizing that I had to get stuck in and build a solution. And that solution was just me building a little website one weekend that has taken on a life of its own 6 years later and become this, yeah, Africa's largest student housing platform.
With interesting other routes and interesting other offshoots and interesting other potentials as well, and we'll get there, but it's a very vulnerable book, and very few people, when they write books about themselves, tell a particularly clear version of the truth. And this is why I say, do you have an edit button? And you go, no, not really. You talk about really struggling at school. You talk about, you know, in primary school at St. George's Prep in Gqeberha, then Port Elizabeth, telling, I mean, as a fairly precocious, I would assume, five-year-old, that your teacher was stupid. And your parents being called into a meeting with the head teacher, and you're going, well, it's because she is stupid. And I think that attitude is not something that has gone away.
No, I think for better or for worse, I've learned to temper myself. I think I've learned how to pick my battles. Some things are worth fighting, and sometimes you've just got to compromise. And I think that you also don't make progress on making enemies. And so I think that I've definitely learned, especially in my work in the government, that, you know, this is just a way to phrase things, and yes, outrightly calling a teacher stupid, you know, when you're 5 years old, is not the way to do it.
It's a good way to learn a lesson early on, especially because you were asked by the president to run the National Youth Development Agency, which you've been doing alongside, of course, the Digs Connect business. Does privilege, being born into privilege, help? I mean, your dad is a well-known skin specialist in the Eastern Cape. Your mum, I think, a top-flight lawyer, very formidable woman in her own right. You didn't, you know, grow up struggling for money. Did that privilege help?
Yeah, my mum is absolutely formidable, just to really lean into that. She terrifies everyone, including all the mayors of Gqeberha. I think she has them all on a tight leash. In terms of my upbringing, you know, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it would be completely disingenuous not to say that. You know, I think that, you know, having what is without a doubt the, you know, the incredible safe harbor, you know, that my parents, especially my father, provided for me, definitely gives, you know, a lot of peace of mind. You know, I think he provided this incredible platform that allowed me to use it as a strong foothold to reach for the stars. And I think that, you know, the question I have, you know, you spoke of my work with the National Development Agency, I'm a director on the board. The question is, how do you kind of create the same opportunities and that same strength of security in their foundation for more South Africans? They feel like they can do that, and they feel like they have got a solid foothold. It's been instrumental, I'd say, is the foundation my parents laid for me. And I'm incredibly grateful for that and incredibly aware of that. And also think that's why not only has it been exciting building a company, I think to a large extent it's also a responsibility to create value in the world and to build for the future and to really kind of take on, you know, some of the problems that we're facing as a country and as a world, being like, what can I actually do about it? Not just be a consumer, but, you know, create as much as I can, provide value. I think that if you are born into a life where you're lucky enough to have privilege, the question is, what do you do with that?
Some of your motivation, does it come from being an outsider yourself for many years? You go to private schools, you have a hugely privileged upbringing. Before you go to university, you go traveling to go, and I think you have a bit of a teen meltdown, if you like, a real sense of you need purpose in your life. And I think you really struggle with that for a while at least.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of my friends is a fantastically just successful, incredible founder based out in Berlin. And what he always says is that the best founders are always the most, have the most issues. You know, have a bit of a bone to pick with the world. They have a little chip on their shoulder. And he says, you know, never underestimate a smart person with a chip on their shoulder, which I always found quite funny. I think it's, you know, when I was 17, this whole idea I was going to go to India and sort of find the meaning of life. And I think this idea of like searching for something, I don't think people should suffer, but I think they should struggle. I think you should struggle against something, I think you should want something, should you be hungry for something more, you know, whatever it is you're looking for, I think you need to look for that. And I think it can drive you, you know, for better or for worse. I think you look at some people that have done some amazing things in the world, they definitely have their demons. And the question is, you know, I think all of us have our struggles. How do you use that to kind of push you, to drive you, and to into, you know, being the person you want to be? And I think also the reason why I think struggling is beneficial and has a place in our lives is because I think it also keeps us humble sometimes. I think, you know, if you work really hard and you see the fruits of your labor and you get successful, I think it's really exciting. But every now and again, it's kind of being humbled a bit by the hard times of life. I think it's really important to, you know, to kind of keep a level head, to keep a very grounded approach to life, and also to remind you that, you know, about why you're doing the work you're doing. You know,
no, exactly. But I mean, and
the world.
Yeah, lots of people go, you know, our purpose is to do X, Y, Z, to be loved by our customers and stuff. What DigsConnect does, DigsConnect is not a logical business. It is a solution to a big problem, which you've managed to turn into a business, and you've drawn investment to it because you make money off the number of rentals that people sit on your platform and people who book them. And it's not a logical business, is it? I mean, there are many easier ways, I think, to make money than effectively an Airbnb for students that has got a massive surge in demand at one point in the year, which is January, and all hell breaks loose when people realize they haven't got accommodation. And then it becomes a bit tricky after that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a very seasonal business. That's 100% for sure. And, you know, I think going into it, we didn't plan on building a business. The idea wasn't to become an entrepreneur. The idea was just to solve problems on my desk. You know, when I was in the SRC, the problem on my desk was, how do I help these students that are homeless? And if you look right now, I think it was a month ago, 2 months ago, there was photos on the front page of every newspaper of students arriving at DPUT, yeah, and literally nowhere to go. And they're turning one of the sport halls into would look like, you know, a makeshift almost refugee camp, because once again, public sector had failed to plan for the lack of infrastructure on student housing. And that was the problem I was facing when I was in SRC. It's this massive issue. And the question was, what did I do to solve it? So I think it started about not being like, how can I make money out of this, but how can I just provide value? And that should be the root cause of what every entrepreneur starts with. Obviously, you know, you want to provide, you want to grow a company, it becomes a unicorn, you know, you're looking at, or a decacorn is the new phrase I'm hearing these days. And
a
how
what?
To do that, but I think it has to, a decacorn. Bruce, a decacorn's the new thing. Everyone's talking about decacorns.
Oh my goodness, I can't keep up. I can't count that far. Now, okay, so now you and your business partner meet up at university. You bond deeply, and you set up on this extraordinary journey, and it gets to a point where you go, we have to take this thing global. And you go and base yourself in the UK. I don't know whether you're between here and there or here or where you are in the world, but are you finding a business model that starts in the battleground of fees must fall in other markets?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that I think was so interesting, you know, for me to experience was, you know, this started at UCT. It was a UCT solution. It was my friends. It was the people at my university. It was the Diggs's around campus, you know, the walk up to campus every day. It was a UCT thing. And then all the other universities around Cape Town and then Stellenbosch and Johannesburg started asking for it. And we were like, okay, this is a national issue. And then when we started working, you know, offshore, we had this amazing partnership we signed, and we started working in, you know, in London, across the UK, went to Amsterdam. And I've never seen such a bad housing crisis in my life than I've seen in Amsterdam. It is insane. You know, even when I was in Jaipur in the States, you know, it seems to be a global issue. There's a lack of organization around the infrastructure available for housing and those looking for it. And similarly to how, like, Google's mantra was, how do we organize the world's information? What I'm thinking is, how do we organize the world's housing in a way that makes sense for everyone? And it's almost like this base of Maslow's hierarchy is, where do you live? You know, where do you go to sleep every night? And globally, it hasn't been solved to, like, an excellent degree. And it's a global application. In terms of the model, I think our model does make sense because it's, you know, we get paid when everyone wins. You know, the landlords are happy, they found a tenant, they clipped their mortgage, the tenants are happy, they got a place to stay, and we get paid. That makes sense. There's definitely more exciting ways you can model that, and more ways that we can add different revenue verticals, and we are exploring all of that. But I think we definitely want to lock down our core model, our core business, and then kind of grow from there, especially growing on our own terms and being off the sort of investment hamster wheel, which we've now finally locked down.
And you get into business with student.com for a while, but it does get to a point where, toward the end of your book, and I'm not too sure how that has evolved, and because you live your life very transparently, I see you posting on social media that, oh, this is a critical week, and then you go very quiet in terms of the future of Digs Connect. There was a very strong alignment between you and student.com, and then you kind of figured, hold on a second, they're not acting in your best interest. You can go along and be dragged along like a mug. And you and your business partner, Greg, I think it is, both agree that actually you are better off on your own. And you go back on your own. And you almost back to not square one, but certainly not at square 100. And I wonder where you are in the journey of Digs Connect now.
Go your own terms. I think as soon as you go into a negotiation and you're not willing to back away, you've basically lost. You know, you can't be willing to trade up absolutely everything for a deal to go through. I think you have to meet people on equal terms. And especially in the way that they wanted us to join, I think we had to show, you know, who we were and like the strength of the situation. And it is definitely harder doing it yourself sometimes. But I think doing it on your own terms is really, really important. So yeah, you know, we had to just make the right decision for the company at the time and see what evolves there. Got an incredibly strong relationship with the student.com team. The CEO, a man called Luke Nolan, who's incredible. You know, he also wrote some words for the book on the back cover. He wrote that, and he's a mentor, and in every way feels like an older brother to me. He's absolutely incredible. So we still work very closely with them. And I think that you can keep really good friendships with colleagues or with, you know, rival competitor companies sometimes even. I think it's possible to have a civil relationship while working, you know, in different businesses. And I think we've definitely managed
respect,
to do that.
Respect is a powerful thing, isn't it? I mean, you've seen what you built, you've seen what they've built, and frankly, I think there's a mutual admiration society there, right?
Yeah, we actually also are very similar, funny enough. So I think that, you know, the respective COOs of the company, so Greg at Digs Connect and James at his company, are extremely similar. And the rest of the team's also very grounded, and Luke and us, all these wild cards. We're still going off on our own mission a million miles an hour, and we're in the same room. We just riffed up each other's energy, and I was actually in Dubai, you know, for the birth of his daughter. So we're very similar, and a lot of respect.
Yeah. I was in reading the book, and please forgive this, but I can't help myself. There was a point I'm reading the book, and I'm going, oh, what? I'm thinking, what a brat. She doesn't like her first name. She doesn't like Claire. Parents chose Claire, and she changes it. To Alexandria, and everybody's got to call her Alexandria. And she is she precocious? Is she chaotic? Is there a bit of ADD in there? And you touch on that. And I wonder whether or not, frankly, a little bit of chaos is actually a good and beautiful and powerful force, provided you are tempered, perhaps, with somebody on the other side of that spectrum.
You know, Bruce, there's this phrase that I really love. Chaos is a ladder.
Chaos is a ladder. Explain.
Chaos is a ladder. You know, I think one thing I really love and respect in the world is when things feel really uncertain and a bit all over the place and everyone's kind of losing their heads, you know, when you get those characters kind of step up and they have such clear thinking and they got such a cool head. And they keep it together and they don't get in a flap and they don't get flustered. And they just, you know, lay out a very clear action plan, a strategy. They know where they're going. They know how we're all going to get there. And I always respected that so, so much. And I think as much as possible, how do you get that? But in terms of, you know, being chaotic oneself, I think that in a certain extent, you have to have a huge risk for appetite to do these kind of things. I think you have to be able to lean into the chaos and enjoy the storm. And I think that, yeah, like you mentioned, I think having, you know, powerful people in your life, and by powerful, I mean the sense that they're strong and determined, but also who you respect. So when they say, you know, rein it in, or, you know, you're too scattered or focus on this, you actually listen to them. And then also working on yourself to realize, you know, picking your battles. When do you fight? When do you actually just hone it in? When do you take the lead? And when do you actually step back, you know, and shut up and listen, which is as important.
Alexandra Proctor, it's a really lovely book. I laughed all the way through. I learnt a huge amount. I was filled with admiration for what you guys have achieved. And I just love the spirit with which Digs Connect has been built, its origin story, and of course, the potential growth path for the story. The author of a book called Upstart. So if you're going to start a business, what would you do? Ideally, it's something that you're good at. Certainly something that you care deeply about. As Pavlos taught us over many, many years, a business where there's a problem that needs solving and you can resolve it can lead to a business. And boy, what do we have plenty of in South Africa? Something that really needs solving. Yeah, pollution. We have plenty of pollution that needs solving. Politicians. Yeah, we need to solve politicians. Something that is possibly more soluble is conflict. And it's something that is solvable. As my guest this evening on How I Make Money, Andre Flock, has learned over many years, he's a conflict and employment dispute specialist. Andre, lawyers are associated with conflict, adversarial conflict. If you're looking for a fight, put two lawyers into separate rooms and they will find a way to fight with each other. You seem to have turned the whole lawyer business model upside down.
Hello, Bruce. Yes, I don't want that to sound as if I planned every step of the way. I got into the legal field. I did that for a good 20 years, then got quite bored with it. I started seeing alternatives to the tools that are available to lawyers. And from there, the last 7 years, this is what I've been doing with my life.
What was the catalyst for it? I mean, for Alexandra Proctor, we just spoke to her about her fabulous book called Upstart. It was the fees must fall crisis that led to the creation of Digs Connect. Was there an epiphany? Was there a moment where you went, actually, no, let's bring peace rather than conflict?
A sort of a slow motion epiphany, if there is such a thing, happening over many years, and it's only when I look back at it that it makes sense. I had a litigation practice, a successful litigation practice, and I had a bank manager sitting across my desk and saying, "My wife is having an affair. I'm told that you're the man to speak to really hurt this woman." He used other language, and I went home asking myself, is that me? Is that what I'm known as? Is that what I want to do with the rest of my life? And by then I had started doing my own private study on mediation and conflict resolution as an art, as a science. And then it starts getting progressively more and more difficult to explain to myself that, you know, the one hammer, one nail is really the best.
Yeah, because is there a difference between mediation, arbitration, conflict resolution? Are there sort of three sides of the same coin?
Yeah, sure. They are. I always find it the easiest to explain it as different tools in a box. Conflict is ever present. Conflict will be with us whether we like it or not, and it's a good thing. Try to imagine a world, your own world, your own professional or personal life without conflict. It really doesn't work that way. So those are tools in how we address. If we accept, as I think we should, that conflict is ever present, then the question becomes, what do we do with it? And then we need to look in the toolbox. What is there? What can we use? Mm. And that's how we find mediation, litigation, sulking, screaming, chatting, politics, and then we need to see what are our own skill levels. How do we know to assess which tool is the correct one, and how do we apply that to the conflicts around us? Because then,
energy. What is the definition then of mediation versus arbitration versus conflict resolution, if there is a difference between the three?
There's huge differences. Mediation that we find, the easiest example that we all should have some knowledge of is at the CCMA, for example. It's one of the, you know, it's the MNCCMA. Mediation is where someone such as myself, such as the CCMA, would try to resolve a conflict between two or more parties where that party, that mediator, does not have institutional power to make a decision. I can help you and your friend with your conflict. I can assist you. I can bring my experience. I can bring the skills that I have to try and resolve it for you. But I cannot make a decision such as an arbitrator would, such as a judge would.
Okay.
Now, that, of course, has tremendous benefits as well. You know, the science, the case studies show us in certain cases that is exactly what a conflict needs, not to have that confrontational, that adversarial approach to resolution.
And again, in the process where you've got two parties, both who are absolutely adamant that they are right, or one person who, in the case of your bank manager friend, wants to hurt the other party, yes, whatever language they choose to use, it's an incredibly negative process. It's a process of wanting justice. It's almost like going to a duel adorned with swords or pistols. No one's going to be satisfied until there is blood. In the fullness of time, I think we all grow up enough to realize that that's not really the way we get the best result.
If we can get back to our discussion about the tools in the toolbox, there are certain things we don't mediate with a rapist. We don't mediate with a child molester. But when there's a relationship at stake, even if we are going to get divorced, even if I am going to be dismissed, even if you and I don't necessarily have to work together again, but there is some sort of a relationship, a family relationship, a working relationship that we need to mix into the conflict, then those adversarial tools, such as litigation, is an absolute awful solution to the problem. There we need to resolve things without sugarcoating them, but still resolve them properly and transcend the conflict in a proper way. And litigation is a very, with all respect, after 20 years, it's an extremely blunt tool. Sometimes, yes, it is the correct thing to do, but I would say it's the correct tool. It's overused, if my lawyer friends forgive me. It's often seen as the only way out. You're not listening to me. I'm not making progress, so I'm going to sue you. And it really is a very limited conflict tool.
We're talking to André Flock this evening. He is a conflict and employment dispute specialist. He is a negotiator. He's a mediator. He's written books. He is a guy who helps people solve seemingly irresolvable problems. I wonder if there are any problems. There are insoluble. We'll pick up with André Flock in just a moment. Have you ever been so furious that you just want to have the skin ripped off somebody else's body? Not literally, understand. I mean, you just want really them to feel pain and anguish. You want them to understand how cross you are. So you want to sue them, as a friend of mine says. No, it's not always the best solution. We're talking to André Flock, who makes his living by helping people resolve conflict. And not all sort of conflict resolution is all about compromise, I would assume here, André. Sometimes an objective voice needs to come into the middle of the conflict and say, you are wrong, you are right, and you do need to pay John, you know, 10 rand in order to settle this particular dispute. That is the solution. Do you both accept it? I mean, it's that sort of tough conversation, unemotional, based purely on facts.
You put your finger on the difference between people who are doing their conflict management from the 80s and those who understand modern conflict management. Compromise is generally, with very few exceptions, compromise is a bad idea in big, medium, and small conflicts. Compromise, a definition of compromise is I give something away that I would have preferred to keep. And that causes resentment, it causes rigidity, it causes future conflicts, cyclical conflicts. Compromise, with very few exceptions, is a lazy, unskilled way of approaching conflicts. We see it in our politics. Our politicians run around focusing on short-term solutions. They compromise where they know it won't last. And really, it's irresponsible. It is conflict resolution from the 80s. And it's a question of you're making things worse, because round two would be worse than round one. Compromise as a conflict strategy is wrong on several levels.
Okay, so it's about having an objective voice who can spell out the facts to both parties. You were wrong there. You're completely wrong here. You could have done better here, but ultimately you are, you know, liable for a settlement, or you just need to pay your damn bills, or whatever the case might be.
Yeah. There's also, once you start, it's quite instructive to take boardrooms through this. Once you start working with conflict in as a problem solving exercise, not as a soft skill, not as a let's all play nice and get along. That doesn't work. Conflict management is about winning. Conflict management, successful modern conflict management, is about what is the best way of resolving and transcending this conflict in front of me. And conflict management, that could mean litigation. It could mean dismissing someone. It could mean a range of things. And that's where the creativity comes in. And for compromise, neutrality, for example, is a bad thing. You can, once you start working with it, once you start seeing the results, you find that it's not always necessary to have a wrong and a right party without being patronizing, without ducking, without condoning wrong behavior. You really can resolve, especially in the workplace, you can resolve a tremendous amount of conflict without having that, Andre, you're wrong, Bruce is right, say sorry, and now we move on. That's often a barrier to resolution. And human nature tells us, you can see it, especially in the workplace, people know that when they're wrong. It's just, what do we do with that? Are we now going to turn that into an obstacle? Remember, there's identity conflicts where I may know that I'm wrong. I may be quite prepared to move along and to adhere to the rule. But if you're going to turn this into a racial thing or a gender thing or a class thing, now that we've created a secondary conflict, now it's not just about me being late. Now it's about something else. And we make that mistake on a nearly daily basis because of this right wrong dichotomy that we insist on.
Yeah, and there are subtleties, I suppose, to conflict resolution, which are often missed in the heat of the moment. And because both of us are equally cross because of either a miscommunication or misinterpretation, or simply that one person was wrong and one is right, whatever it is, we both get adamant. We dig in our heels and we want justice. And often that desperate search for justice doesn't give you the best result.
We see it in so many very graphic examples. I was working with a family in America the other day with a mother that lost her child through a really senseless murder. Now, justice for her is what? Does she focus on that? Does she focus on the murderer being executed or not? Or does justice for her, in my example, lie in forgiveness, in herself being set free, regardless of the murder? So justice itself becomes very tricky and very nuanced in itself. Justice as an insistence to move on can add layers of complexity to conflict. Sure.
What have you had to learn as somebody who was involved in conflict, in litigation? That's the definition, I suppose, of legal conflict is the litigation process. What have you had to learn over the last 7 years to make you more effective as somebody who brings resolution to conflict in a way that is not necessarily bloodlust and satisfaction on that regard, but where ultimately the person seeking some sort of, I hate the word, I'm not even going to use the word closure. If I was to use the word closure, you would understand. But you want this thing to be finished. What have you had to learn as somebody who has operated in a particular fixed way for a long time to a far more lateral thinking sort of approach to solving problems?
I love the question because I struggled with it so much over such a long period of time. I come from a background, both my family just my family background and then my professional background as well, where you have a right and a wrong. I'm right, you're wrong. And either you listen to me in 30 seconds or I'll sue you. And you know, that is the way that the world was done and run. To walk away from that and to understand that I am actually making things worse. I am not helping myself. Leave aside you. You know, conflict management isn't about being nice and polite and let's look after Bruce. Who cares about Bruce? It's about me. What about my interests? It can be a terribly selfish exercise if you want it to be. And to learn that, to understand that, coming from, you know, my background and my training, to see it with it. It's not about being nice. It's not about being polite. What is the best way of resolving this conflict for me? And some of those answers, you know, I made this lateral move at age 53, and old dogs and new tricks. It took a while, and once you see it, once you see the value, once you see the practical benefits, that it's not just talk, that it actually works. And that is why I left the comfort zone of where I was into this at that age, was because it works. If you do it properly, if you use the modern tools, it actually works. And for me to take that leap to actually, you know, to make peace with those changes, that I was doing it wrong all those years, and that there is a better way, that took some gulps to get swallowed.
Andre, thank you very much for sharing how you make money. The conflict and employment dispute specialist, the negotiator, the mediator, and also an author. Andre Flock is his name. Thank you for sharing on the